Hello and welcome to Agents of Hope. My name is Ella Mansfield and this is the third and final episode in the Understanding Voices mini-series. Today we're in for something a little bit different. I'm joined by Bambi French, who's my first non-educational psychologist guest. Bambi is a Senko at a mainstream secondary school and she's also a visual impairment activist and coach and hosts a podcast called She is VIP. A link for which I'll put in the description because it's well worth a listen. So, Bambi, hi. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Ella. Thanks for having me today.
No problem at all. It's nice to have you. So, what shall we start with today? You're obviously a woman of many talents. where would you like to start?
many talents. I can sing for you. I could dance, although you wouldn't be able to see that. I guess, but my story, my background, and we could start from there.
So I am
a Senko in a mainstream secondary, as you've already said. I have been doing that work for about 12 years now in a couple of different secondary schools within the northeast of England. But my interest in special needs, I suppose, started when I had just finished university and did some work in some special needs schools, you know, at that point at university where you finish your degree and you're not quite sure what you want to do. But I knew I wanted to work with kids and work in caring for children in some way. So just went into doing some work with children with special needs and just really it developed from there. I am somebody with additional needs. I do have a visual impairment. I was diagnosed when I was 15 years old with a disease called Stargardt's, which affects my central vision. So seeing distance and detail is something that's quite difficult for me. So I was that kid or one of those kids at school with a statement of special educational needs, which is what it was called at that time, and needed all of the additional support in order to be able to access the curriculum and all of the different things around school. So I feel like I had firsthand insight into what it was like to be a child in school with additional needs and really just wanted to be able to use my own personal experience to help other children and families kind of navigate the difficulties that can come with living with a disability and trying to do all the things that school and society kind of demands from you. So that's kind of my story in a nutshell, I suppose.
So you mentioned that you were a person with additional needs, visual impairment. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about what that might have been like from sort of an activist point of view, in that you're now trying to help people with visual impairments, maybe whether they're at school or, you know, like older people in the workplace. I'm just wondering, were you diagnosed with that when you were at school and did it have an impact on you then?
Yeah, so I was diagnosed at 15. I think when I think back, I was, the condition was developing around the age of 10, 11 years old, because I specifically remember transferring to secondary school and not being able, I was sat at the back because we were sat in alphabetical order, and at the time my name meant that I was sitting right at the back, and I remember not being able to see very well, and that was, you know, still in the time when there was chalk and the blackboard, you know, so I remember not missing quite a bit of information but not really understanding why. So yeah, it did have quite a major effect, because I think at that time you just want to fit in, you just want to be like everybody else and do what everyone else is doing, and then to discover that you have a condition that is not something that can be treated by just wearing glasses or getting laser treatment, wearing contacts, all of those sorts of things, but something that's going to have quite a significant impact on the way in which you do life, it was really hard. Being diagnosed at 15, you know, by that age I was thinking, well, I might be able to drive a car and do all the things that all, you know, the other kids around me were doing, and then to be told, actually, you're not going to do that, it's not great, because you've kind of built up in your mind how your life's going to be when you suddenly become independent and you can go where you want to go and do the things you want to do without the help of your parents or anyone else. I think the other thing as well was that I was very independent up until that point, and then to suddenly have to have all of this help, you know, within school, especially having someone sit with me to take the notes from the board and to have enlarged papers, because at the time technology wasn't as advanced as it is now, in order for me to be able to access what was going on, I had these huge A3 pieces of paper that were all over my desk. So it was very, there was no way of hiding the fact that I couldn't see. Everybody knew, and I felt very conspicuous and just different. And you don't want to be different at that age, because you're just trying to fit in and get through the best you can. So it was difficult.
Yeah. So that difference and kind of being sort of outed, I suppose, by the equipment and the things that you needed, it sounds like it was very difficult for you at the time. I know that you've spoken quite a lot. Obviously, before we started recording, we had a chat about things, and I've listened to you explaining things on your podcast. You talk quite a lot about identity and sort of what it means, I suppose, to be a person who has a visual impairment. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, there's I suppose with the podcast and what I'm trying to do is to help people with a visual impairment understand that there is more to them than the disability. I think the idea of having a disability or additional need can be all consuming sometimes, because you're so focused on the thing that you can't do and the things that a particular disability stops you from being able to do. But it's understanding that you're more than that. People will say, oh, yeah, but that's a given. Yeah, everybody knows that they're more than the one thing that they find is a negative in their lives or that they find difficult. But actually, it's something that you have to really work to understand, because when you have a disability like a visual impairment, it can be so difficult to do life and do it well and to keep on doing it in spite of that physical difficulty, because every day you're confronted with the thing that you find most difficult, or that it takes a little bit longer to do something because of the difficulty that you face. I look at, my focus is people with visual impairments, but I look at everyone with a disability and say, well, how is it that you are understanding all of you? How is it that you are understanding what it is you're good at? What are your strengths? What are the skills? What is it that you bring to the table? We talk a lot about inclusion and how we can include people with additional needs in what we're doing. But how do we, as people with additional needs, include ourselves in what's going on as well? We can stay in our little groups, and we can form groups around whether it's visual impairment or autism or those things, and that's really good. But at the same time, how do we include ourselves in what is going on? And yeah, the whole idea of identity and who I am and who we all are as individuals and then as a collective is really important.
Yeah, definitely. I love that idea of celebrating people, like, no matter sort of what's going on. I think that it's something that I've seen a fair amount with other kind of diagnoses, you know, with autism, and for me with ADHD, something that I've spoken to guests on the Understanding Voices miniseries quite often is that identity and how you label yourself, and you kind of take on the stereotypes that other people have put on you, which seems completely unfair, particularly for young people and children, where they're just kind of being lumped with this new idea of themselves, and how do they fit into that category and how don't they?
Absolutely, yeah.
So, yeah, the other thing I wanted to say about identity is that you can, just from working with the families that I've worked with and also myself, being diagnosed with a disability can either add positively or negatively to your identity, depending on how you already see yourself. As a Black woman, you know, you can already, as an ethnic minority woman, you're already starting to think, well, I have to work a little bit harder to get to where I want to be. And, you know, things are going to be a little bit more difficult for me because of the way in which people see me. So then to be an ethnic minority, to then have a disability, you're then starting to tick off all of the things that could potentially count against, you know, you as a person and being able to move forward. In the same way, when I work with children from low socioeconomic backgrounds who then have additional needs on top of that, it can add to their idea about who they are and can actually lower their self-esteem. And what it is I'm trying to do is helping people actually raise that self-esteem, that of being diagnosed with any kind of disability doesn't have to add to the maybe the negative view of the identity that you have or that someone else has of you. That there's a lot more positive in that than there is negative.
Absolutely. And I think with your podcast, you just put forward such an important message. So I wonder if you could just tell the listeners a little bit about what you do there.
Yeah. So She Is a VIP was born out of partly frustration on my part of thinking that actually in the last 25, 30 years, I'm not sure whether I've seen as big a shift as I thought I would like to have seen in the way that people are diagnosed and then what happens next, mm-hmm. how they feel about themselves. You know, we've just been talking about identity, how they feel about themselves and what they feel is possible. And what they can achieve, you know, you can hear all the motivational speeches and you can listen to all the podcasts and read the books and things like that. So you can. But at the same time, how many understand what it means to actually live with that difficulty? There's kind of work to be done if you live with a disability already and know that there are certain things you can't do. Mm-hmm. So it's been born out of that. On the one hand, and on the other hand, it's based around my story. You know, when I was diagnosed at 15, I just vividly remember walking out of the hospital, having received that diagnosis and being told, you might be blind by the time you're 30, you won't be able to do this, you won't be able to do that, you're going to find this difficult. And I remember just walking out with my mum and thinking, what's going to happen now, mm-hmm. you know, what am I going to be able to do now, who's going to help me, does anyone even, and you know, I walked out of the hospital in London in King's Cross, is like the busiest place, what felt like the busiest place on earth at that point, mm-hmm. and it was getting dark, and I just had that sense that no one could see me, mm-hmm. no one could see me, and nobody knew. Yeah, okay, well, I could have, I don't know, stood on a wall and shouted, this is what I've got. But it felt really, really small and really insignificant in that moment, and thought, I'm not going to be able to do any of the things that I thought I was going to be able to do and live the life I thought I was going to be able to live. And yes, since then I've gone on and I've done degrees and advanced in my career and done well, not without frustration, but I've done those things. But what I'm seeing in my work now is me at 15 again and again and again through the children and the families that I work with, still coming out and still having those same questions and thinking those same things and not really having a direct path to something or someone who can just say, do you know what, you are still of massive importance. You still have a place here in this world that you've been born in, you know, and you still have purpose and you still have an impact to make. It doesn't matter that you have this diagnosis now. Yes, there are some things you're not going to be able to do or that you'll find more difficult or that you'll need more help with, but there absolutely is something that you need to be doing and that you need to contribute to the world. And I think the earlier that we can instill this belief in kids or with anyone who just recently receives a diagnosis, the better that will be. You know, it's trying to kind of stave off those feelings of just, you know, helplessness, which you will feel. All those things are normal feelings. I still feel frustrated some days and I still get, you know, anxious some days about new things that I need to start, but it's just raising that level and saying, look, there's so much still available, there's so much still in front of you to achieve, and not just so that you can achieve that for yourself, but so you can help someone else, because there's someone else who's like 5 steps behind you who needs to hear what you have to say, who needs to hear about how you got through that thing, you know. And then that way we can keep just bringing up the next, the person behind us, even if it's just one person, just help that one person. Yeah. And so the work that I do with She Is a VIP and the coaching is around helping people really focus on a vision, focus on the vision that they have for their lives, and not about what they can physically see. But I really talk about vision being about the state of your heart and the state of your mind, and the strength that lies within focusing on the bigger picture. All of these phrases that we use that are linked to sight, but focus on the bigger picture. What is it that you can do to have just such a positive impact in the world?
Yeah, I love that. It reminds me of in Michelle Obama's autobiography, she talks about how you've got to leave the door open and help other people get through that door that you've already walked through. That's like a rubbish synthesis of what the quote is about. But yeah, it's that kind of thing, isn't it? It's saying, I found this difficult and it's important that I give you that knowledge so that you find that slightly less difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you go back a lot to that feeling that you had when you were 15 coming out of the hospital, and that feeling of kind of, I suppose, how would you describe it? Sort of like loneliness and lostness.
Yeah, if I can describe we were in the hospital all day, so we didn't leave. So by the time we left, it was evening, like, you know, the sun had pretty much gone down. But then when I think back to that day, it was so it was like it was really misty but getting dark. But then I had like a whole day of dilation drops. Actually, my vision was cloudy, but for another reason. But the actual internal feeling of this is not good. And I had my mum with me at the time, who was like just completely worried and stressed. I can't remember what she was saying. In fact, I can't remember what she was saying at the time, but she was really worried. That's why the podcast is for those of us women, yes, who have visual impairments, but also the people who care for them, because what they go through and what goes through their minds is as important as what's going on with the person with the need as well. Mm. Any number of feelings that actually were negative, there were none. There was nothing at the time, I don't think, that was thinking, all right, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to, you know, I was just thinking, well, how am I going to get, I was year 10. So that was like the start of GCSEs. How am I going to finish these exams? You know, how quickly is this going to deteriorate? What am I going to do, and who is going to understand enough to be able to help me do what I need to do? So it was a really, yeah, I would say scary time. But like I say, I still see that in the children that I work with and the teens that I work with. I still see that fear. I see that fear in the parents, you know, who are just had all these dreams for their children. And I wouldn't say had, I always encourage them to still have them. We might need to go a different route, but we still got to have them. But they have had all these dreams for their children, and then they're just so concerned about how it is they're gonna make it through.
Mm. Yeah, so it's that sort of mentoring, isn't it? So you mentioned that your mum found it really difficult, and I think that's something that I've never really thought about before. There's a few things I hadn't thought about before with visual impairment. I think number one was that, you know, if somebody is, and forgive me if I get their phrases wrong here, because, you know, I'm new to it, so I'll give it a go. Number one was if somebody is like, is it legally registered as blind? Is that the phrase, or have I got that wrong?
I think they call it legally registered in like, I think that's in America. I'm registered blind, or registered severely sight impaired.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's the registered bit about? I'm just interested.
Well, you're a number. You're another number.
Okay.
The registration means that the social services are aware of your need. It then has implications for like your tax and that kind of thing. You know, it's just, okay. Yeah, to know. And then I suppose in the future, if I needed any additional support, then yeah. You can have all of that thing, and people have things like my access to work and things like that are all tied into that. So as soon as you get that registration after your diagnosis, then there is a lot of support that is open to you.
So it's just a way of people being able to track, or like inform people if they need to, I suppose.
Yeah, inform people. Yeah, yeah. And then also if I need things, then yeah, it's available to me.
Yes, sorry, I got a bit distracted there. But yeah, so if somebody is registered as blind, that doesn't necessarily mean that they can't see anything. Which is something I hadn't really thought about before.
Yeah, no, it's the level of sight which you have. Mm. It's all done on levels, and I actually couldn't even tell you what, you know, what it is. But I know I'm severe enough to be registered as blind and not partially sighted. Yeah, and when I tell people that, they're like, no way, you're not. Yeah, yeah, I am. I don't use a cane or a dog or anything like that, but I am, yeah.
So for you, you were saying it was the centre of your sight that is more difficult.
Yeah.
I suppose if we try and frame it in terms of when you were at school, and obviously it sounds like it was something that kind of came on gradually. How was it kind of, you said that you couldn't see the whiteboard at school.
Yeah, well, it was the blackboard at the time, so the blackboard of chalk at the time. So I couldn't see that. And I remember, it must have been before I was diagnosed, and I knew that things were getting worse, but we were waiting for the appointments to go and find out what was wrong. And I remember more than once, a few times, standing outside of the science lab, and we had a particularly challenging teacher. But that site doesn't even make sense, does it? Do you ever hear about challenging teachers? Challenging students, but this teacher for me was particularly challenging in that her lesson started on the hour and finished on the hour. She wasn't waiting for anyone. There was none of this kind of differentiation that we do now. There was none of that. It was just like, I'm starting at 10, finishing at 11. If you keep up, then you keep up. So I figured out, right, I was really good at, I just got very good at listening to what was going on. Mm. And she used to write and speak. So as she wrote on the board, she would speak. And it's fine if you could see, then you had that opportunity to kind of, you know, be a bit distracted as you can when you're in your tent, talk to your friend or do something else and then get back on and catch up. I didn't have that. I didn't have that luxury because I couldn't see what she was writing on the board. So I literally had to spend the entire hour listening with intent and write everything that she was saying and keep up with how quickly she was speaking as well. By the end of the lesson, absolutely exhausted, and I did that over and over and over again until they started to, you know, realize actually there's a problem here and that I needed some help. But it was that kind of coping mechanism that I used, and I think a lot of the people listening to this podcast will be able to relate to that, especially with girls when you're called in as an educational psychologist and you're probably not called in as much for girls as you are for boys. I don't know. Maybe you'll get like tweets even say that that is wrong. But I feel from my experience, it's the boys that get the EP referrals because of their behaviour, because of the thing that they are struggling with, more than likely struggling with within the classroom. And so that translates to them disrupting the behaviour. And then, you know, the school will say, well, this child can't behave. Some girls are a lot more difficult to diagnose because they learn those coping mechanisms. You know, I suppose if I was a 15-year-old boy with this difficulty having to deal with that challenging teacher who was just reeling off notes after, you know, it might have looked a bit different, but I just figured out that's what I needed to do to get by. So that's what I did. Exhausting, absolutely exhausting. And and I think about that. Those are the kinds of things I think about when I'm working with children and trying to help teachers, classroom teachers, understand exactly how difficult these things are for children within the classroom with any kind of difficulty.
Mm. No, I think you're absolutely right. I think particularly with the girls aspect, it's something that we see in autism, ADHD research. My main areas of interest, I suppose. Girls are just, they'll just mask. And people don't notice that anything's going on until they're kind of significantly further along the line than if it was a boy.
Yeah, well, again, that is part of the reason why I'm focused on women and girls.
Yeah.
At the moment, I don't know what it will evolve into. It might evolve into everyone's a VIP, but at the moment, it's the women and girls that I'm focused on because of that reason, is that girls will mask for a long time and they'll cope for a very long time, often until it's too late. You don't see what's going on underneath the surface emotionally with them, and we know that if they become emotionally unstable, if they get into a mindset where they believe that actually they can't do it and what they're doing isn't enough, then none of the academic stuff is going to work. you know, or it will be severely impacted. So raising the self-esteem of girls, of young women who, yes, are living with a disability, in this case a visual impairment, but helping them to understand that it's okay. What we're not trying to do is just develop these coping mechanisms that suppress everything we're feeling all the time is really important, because that suppression is not good for anyone.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, like you said, it's just knackering, isn't it? You can't pretend to be someone you're not.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've done that firsthand. I've done that, and sometimes I forget, and I still try and do that. But at the end of it, or when it's all too much, and I'm completely full, because the more you try and push something down, you know, you keep pushing the stuff down, there's not going to be enough space for it all to it's going to end up coming out in some way, shape or form, and it doesn't end up coming out very well if you keep trying to suppress those things. So yeah, I'm on the learning journey as well, you know. Yeah. I'm constant work in progress, but what I want to do is be able to help, you know. I've been on the journey for a little while now, so if I can help others realize a little bit more of their potential, a little bit more of who they are, that, you know, their disability doesn't define who they are. Yeah. Then that'll be a good job well done, I think.
Absolutely. I think we're all works in progress, aren't we? I think no one's the finished article.
Absolutely.
I loved what you said earlier about talking to parents about their children who had kind of been diagnosed with various things or just visual impairments. And this idea that, you know, they, instead of saying they had hopes and dreams, and they still have these dreams and these expectations for their children, and keeping those expectations really high. You know, is that something that you're trying to really promote, you know, with your coaching?
Yeah. So, like I say, in terms of working with the people who have the disability is one thing, but also making sure that the people looking after and caring for them is, you know, that they remain positive, that they remain strong, that they also don't lose their identity in the caring for that child or that young person is also really important. I mean, I suppose I'm in quite a privileged position in that I get to see like the whole process for a lot of the children. I get to see the point at which a parent will come to me and say, I think there's something not right here, or she or he is having this difficulty in this thing, what can we do, you know, and starting from that point and doing that investigation of what works well for them, what doesn't, where is it they're finding those difficulties. And sometimes, yes, at that point we can figure it out and it's not a major thing and we just need to put a few things in place and, you know, that child is fine. Other times, and increasingly more, there are children who need a lot further investigation, a lot more work to be done to help them and us all find out what's going on. Unfortunately, sometimes that means you want a label. You need something to tell you whether, you know, it's autism. Yes, diagnosed with autism or ADHD or any kind of visual impairment, hearing impairment, that kind of thing. You need something to hang to then hang what you do next on. What I find is that parents will put so much effort into getting to that point of diagnosis, and it does take a lot of effort. Now, any number of people listening will understand the hurdles and the hoops and all the things you have to go through to even get a diagnosis, you know, from the point of referral to diagnosis can be up and down. And parents, carers will use everything they have, both spiritually, emotionally, physically, monetarily, everything they can possibly get their hands on and use, every resource, energy, time to get that diagnosis. And then what? You know, I think there's the idea that if we get this diagnosis, then everything will be all right. Everything will be all right. And that's not the reality. I wish it was in some way. I wish it was. That was the end, you know, of that, because it's like an uphill battle just to get to that point. And you come out with this report and it's like, okay, says he's got this or she's got this. But to me, that's when the real work begins, after getting that report, you know, reading that report. Sometimes I can even read some of these reports and think, it's old. As soon as the ink's dry, it's like it's out of date almost, you know, because the child has grown or developed some different behaviours or has different needs. And it's what comes after that point is the thing that's going to make or break the whole kind of the ongoing process. A diagnosis can, yes, mean that you may well be able to access more resources, that teachers in school will have a better understanding of how to meet the needs. But I still think that only goes so far to making life something that will be a positive experience for both the child and the parent or the carer. So it's what we do. What are the steps that we take? And I'm busy developing something at the moment that will actually go towards helping parents and the person, child with a disability, just stop at that point of diagnosis and say, where am I? What do I have around me? Who do I have around me? What are the things in my life that I need to kind of get into some kind of order so that I can make the next steps? Because you can be given all of the practical things you can do in terms of get involved with this group and find this organization and buy this or do that. But again, I come back to the person and how is that person going to develop and be able to manage, not just manage, but I suppose thrive with in life and in the next step. So it's that whole finding your direction after that diagnosis is really, really important.
Mm. Yeah, sort of parents and the child even might feel like the diagnosis is the end goal. But for us, so SENCOs and EPs and TEPs, it's not the end. That's really, I would say, the beginning, a sort of a short form way of saying you kind of fit into this category. But actually, we still need to look at you as an individual and what's actually going to help you as a person going forward. So then this idea about kind of stopping and thinking after a diagnosis and sort of saying, okay, well, what's next? Is that sort of the form of like a kind of a model or like a coaching sort of a framework? What kind of thing might that be?
Yeah, so I've developed like a vision centered process that I would use in my coaching, and yes it's drawn on like different things that you can use, but I like the idea of like, you know, focusing on vision. So it's things like looking at the things that go, just going, stepping back and looking at the things that you value. So what is important to you, what's important to your child, what's important to the family, whoever's doing the work, you know, kind of it will work for them. And that will help, I think, direct your thoughts as you go forward. You know, when you think about your values, are you worried if you find yourself thinking about, which I think probably, you know, my mum was probably at this point thinking about, well, what will people say? You know, what will my community say? What will it look like to my community? See, it's not about that. You know, it's about looking at the things that are important to you and really understanding your values. Then looking at identity and knowing who you are. So knowing, really, really understanding your strengths and skills and majoring on them and not working on the things that you're not that good at. You know, if you're not that good at them, someone else needs to help you with that. That's fine. But what are the things that you are that you're good at? Yeah, looking at different ways of figuring out, yeah, just who you are, what your strengths are. And then making sure that you strengthen that key areas of your life are strengthened in a way that works for you. So being physically strong, being physically fit is really important as the person with the additional needs, because we know that nutrition and health and wellness then feeds into you being able to do all kinds of different things, you know, and it's good for you to ensure that you are physically well. Your emotional and mental health as well. How is it that you're looking after your emotional and mental health? And lots of people do this in lots of different ways, but it's finding out what works for you and making sure that it's something that you can use. I also talk about like financial health. A lot of people who have disabilities and who are caring for are juggling kind of personal independence payments and different things like that that can put a strain on finances. So it's kind of making sure that you are getting what you need. Are there parts of work that you can do? Just being able to manage the finance that's coming in and making sure that you have what you need. We know the stress that finance can put on people. So it's about just making those key areas as strong as possible. And then finding ways of putting all of this in place that works for you and your life. So it's looking at your values, looking at your strengths, and then thinking, well, how is this then going to work for me? How can I make sure that my emotional health is strong? How can I make sure that my finances, my physical health is strong? But not copying someone else. We talk about individual needs. We all have individual needs. We all have unique ways in which we need to do things. We need to make sure that people find those ways. And then the process of organizing, orientating your life towards this new way. You know, you've got this diagnosis, you found this thing out. We've now got to adjust life to this new way of doing things. There's going to be a lot of changes and a lot of shifts, and that might just be for the individual, but for a family as well. If there are younger children, you know, maybe slightly older children, the whole family is going to have to adjust to maybe there's just one person in the family who has all these additional needs, and how do we work that out? And then the final way is nurture. So I've spelt the word vision. Final way is nurture, where it's about the self-care. Understanding that self-care isn't selfish, isn't a selfish thing. That as a parent, as a carer of someone with additional needs, you have got to find a way of looking after yourself, of looking after the things that you are learning and that you're developing. And as the one with the needs as well, again, looking after yourself, and that it's not always about proving to the next person, I can do that as well as you, and I can, you know, because I've been there too. And that doesn't help anyone. That certainly doesn't help you, you know. So about being able to step back and look after yourself, do the things that you need to do to support your whole being. So yeah, that's kind of the vision centered process in a nutshell. But it's very bespoke. So I would first understand who the person is that I'm working with, and then figure the way through, help them with the way through.
Yeah, it sounds like a really useful model. So you said it can be used for both people with visual impairments themselves and their families.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah, and I've even had people who aren't visually impaired, but are vision impaired. They're saying, well, I can't, you know, I just don't know what I'm going to do next, and I don't know. So it's kind of like, even though it's for visually impaired people and their families, you know, I have people who just need a bit of help with clarifying what it is they need to do. And I think it works for a whole range of people.
Absolutely. It's sort of something that you'd use when somebody is feeling lost, isn't it? You know, a way of, and that relates right back to that feeling that you felt when you came out of the hospital when you're 15. You know, you're then trying to make things better for people that are in a similar situation. It sounds like a really good go-to, actually, that could be used for loads of different things. I'll try and link some more information to it, because I think you've made some episodes based on that, haven't you?
Yes. I have made some episodes based on that.
I think that would be quite a useful tool for people to go and have a look at, definitely. I think we're kind of coming up towards the end of the podcast. And I think what I would really like to kind of talk to you about for the last little bit is just to talk about what can EPs take from this? What would you like an educational psychologist to know about working with people with visual impairments in general, or kind of more specifically working with children and young people with visual impairments?
I mean, in my experience of working with EPs, they have been very much interested in what the child is feeling and what the child is thinking. And that absolutely 100% needs to carry on. That's something that doesn't need to change at all. I suppose with working with a child or children with a visual impairment, it's just understanding, I suppose, how difficult emotionally they feel I think you can be told, oh, this child has a visual impairment, and then you can at surface level think, well, what can they see, what can't they see? But it definitely goes deeper than that. It's how they feel about not being able to see and not being able to do what other children can do. And you know, as I talk about it, and as a Senko, you know, I have children with every kind of need across the board, you know, and I have worked with every kind of need. And I think this goes across the board, really, this whole thing about actually really understanding what that child is feeling. It's more difficult to elicit that from teenagers because they won't necessarily tell you. But having that awareness and understanding that it's like, no matter how much of a mask the kids put up or how much, you know, they say, well, I can do that, or, you know, that's all right. Actually, it's quite a scary time because they don't know. Some children's vision may be deteriorating faster than others, some slower, some are you know, different rates. And they're dealing with that and trying to grow up and trying to do exams and trying to fit in with the friends and trying to do all of that stuff. So yeah, just that real awareness of the emotional impact that this is having on a child would be a good thing to start with, I think.
So looking at the emotional side of things rather than the technical kind of medical side of, I think EPs, yeah, I mean, that's our role anyway, really, isn't it? It's, you know, we're not medical professionals. We're not here to tell you about the nuance of, you know, how far a child can see and whether they can see the board if they're sat at the front of the class or if they're at the back of the class. You know, that should be easy enough. But yeah, I think that's a really nice point, that it's about the emotions behind it. And I love your kind of emphasis on identity. And anyone who's heard my other two podcasts will know that I'm sort of very, very much into that idea of exploring identity in order to help young people. Yeah,
I just think if you can do that, if you can, you're not going to completely dispel the feelings of feeling inadequate, I don't think, or insecure, or, you know, finding things hard. Like I say, you know, I'm 40 plus and and I still have those feelings, I still feel those things. But it's having that idea, and with EPs not so much, but with teachers who may be listening, it's just really, I mean, I'm not teaching granny to suck eggs here, but we have to really get our heads around the fact that these children are only with us in school for such a short amount of time. If you're teaching 11 to 16, 5 years. 11 to 18, 7 years. After that, they've possibly got another 70 years to live, you know, all being well. 70 years. You know, we can do the education. Yes, the education is important. They need to get those qualifications in order to move on. But I always hold, what is the point of all of that when at the end you have a child, a young person who then is unable to use any of it in the world, in the workplace, because they don't have that self-esteem and that confidence hasn't been built. They don't know who they are, their identity, you know, or they place a lot of their identity on the negative rather than the positive. There just doesn't seem to me to be much point. So yes, the focus on emotion, focus on the personal development is really important. Maybe that's what EP should suggest instead for visual impairment, is just put loads of personal development stuff down. Don't put anything down around, you know.
Just leave out all the stuff about in the classroom. They need to know who they are.
Exactly. Don't put anything about math, no English maths.
I mean, we could do both, couldn't we? We could do both.
You could. Major on.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what you've really highlighted to me today is also the importance of mentorship. If you're a young person who's just been told that they've got a visual impairment that's going to get worse over time, or you know, that they're going to find things more difficult in the classroom because of some diagnosis that they've had, and where do you look to, where do you go? And actually you're saying, you know, maybe you need somebody who's already walked that path before, who can help you to work out that everything's going to be okay in the end, and life will be a little bit different, and your identity is going to be a little bit different, and it's going to shift. But you can still do everything that you want to do. It's just a case of almost having that support and knowing where to get it from.
Yeah, isn't that what I'm doing is kind of it's stuff that you can find all over. You know, you can type in visual impairment on YouTube and find people who are doing things, but sometimes, and you know, you can join Facebook groups and you can do all that kind of thing. Sometimes though, it can be a little bit one-sided and you need that conversation, you need that kind of back and forth with someone. And it's being careful as well. You know, sometimes in the groups there can be some level of negativity. Mm. There can be different, you know, so it's just a way of bringing people into a space that is about them, and they're not like, you know, their thoughts aren't drowned out by the noise of the needs of other people. You can't do all the things that I'm talking about, you know, fulfilling your purpose and having impact and being able to be of service to someone else. Actually, you can't do all those things if you don't know where you stand in the picture. And I think if you're coming out and you're just being diagnosed and you need that help, you don't necessarily need the amount of noise that there is around. Kind of need a quiet space to get quiet, to think about what it is you need. And then you can move out and help others.
Put on your own oxygen mask before others or whatever.
Exactly, yeah. And I never understood that. I never understood that until, like, you say that and I was just like, that's mad. Why would I do that when there's a two-year-old next to me? But actually, yeah, I understand. You'd pass out halfway through, yeah.
Yeah, it wouldn't help either of you, would it?
Yeah, thanks for it now.
Okay, right. I think that takes us to the end then, Bambi.
Yeah.
It's been brilliant having you on. It's lovely to have a chat. I've learned so much just talking to you and listening to you on your podcast. And I think whenever something new comes up, for me as a trainee, you know, a child who's got a diagnosis which I'm not aware of, I kind of get blindsided by it for a minute and sort of want to go and research and look at all these things. But I think it all comes down to seeing people as individuals and treating them as such.
Yeah, most definitely.
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much, Bambi.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.